Welcome to episode 18 of the Data Driven Security Podcast. Hi, I'm Jay Jacobs.
And I'm Bob Rudess.
And you're listening to episode 18 of the Data Driven Security Podcast. And Bob, I wanted to start out today and talk about two papers that are not new. They're actually quite old papers. They're from both from the 80s. And because of our last podcast where we had Lane Harrison giving us, feedback on some of the work that you and I did around Verizon's Data Breach Investigations Report and our visualizations in there, I wanted to dive into these papers and talk about what makes a good visualization. So the first paper is from William Cleveland and Robert McGill. And the title of this paper is Graphical Perception and Graphical Methods for Analyzing Scientific Data. And this is actually quite well known. It's from 1985 is when it was published. And the reason it's well known is because on page four, there's a tiny little table in the upper right in page four of this document. And he talks about, he actually did research to find out what visualizations work best, right? For displaying quantitative information. And that is, you know, numbers and things like that in variables. And why this is important, I want to back up here and talk about why this is important. So when we talk about data visualization, this is a communication method. And for anybody who's taken a class in communications, you always start with a message. And in this case, the message is our data. We want to communicate something about that data. So the data has the message itself. And in a normal communication path, you have to encode a message and then put that message into some type of medium. If you're speaking, you encode it in a language and you send it over the airwaves, audio perception. The receiver will receive that message and decode it. In other words, listen to the words that you're saying, realize their words, put meaning to those words and understand the message, the original message. So with data visualization, what we have is, as I mentioned, the message is coming from the data. We need to encode it visually. And when we encode it visually, we have attributes to work with like shape, size, color, position on the page, length, angle, slope, and things like that, that we can use those things to encode the message in the data. And back to Cleveland's paper now, what he did in this paper, Cleveland and McGill, what they did in this paper is that they tested different methods of encoding and the quality and the precision with which people decoded the message. And so what's great about this is that he's actually putting these things to a test and running a clinical study here of how people decode and interpret different representations of data. And so this table, this tiny little table, it's a three column layout, and it's in the third column in the top corner, and it has seven different aspects, visual aspects, and how they were ranked for people properly decoding them. So the first one is position, and it's position along a common scale. And I always think of a scatter plot here. And so if you think of, you know, you've got some quantity along an x-axis, another quantity going up the y-axis, and you put points in there that represent each individual data point. In order to compare these and decode that position into a quantitative number, these are quite precise. People looking at these were quite precise in how they decoded those encodings of that data. The second one is similar, but it's positioned on identical but not aligned scales. So think of two scatter plots next to each other that have the same exact scale, right? And then it drops down for length, which is a very close behind these. And think of a bar chart now where you've got the height of bars or length in a horizontal bar chart. And then after that, it drops down. So now we start talking about angle and slope are in fourth place, followed by area and volume and things like that. And this is one of the reasons that pie charts should not, probably not be the first choice for for visualizing data because it relies on an angle, which is rank number 4, and actually has some fair distance between the length and position 3. And it also has area, right? Because you're looking at the area of a pie chart. And this is another reason that a 3D pie chart will often distort the data because it will enhance the area of what's in front. And however you tilt that pie chart, whatever is in back, will have a smaller area. And so the eye will try and interpret area as a variable and assign incorrect or unprecise meanings. And Bob, am I missing anything on the pie chart there?
I think the only thing I would add is that there's still always other choices. Like I think one that comes to mind would be a waffle chart. You know, it's basically using a series of blocks. You basically divide by a certain number and then, you know, encode things into it. But really the principles, a lot of them that you're describing for the pie charts hold true for waffles. You really can't have too many things there. Otherwise it gets very difficult to read, no matter how well you encode it or lay it out. It's still going to be a problem.
Right. And waffle charts have been used. I remember David Spiegelhalter talking about using them to convey risk, especially in a medical setting. And so he would do things like have 100 blocks. And if the chance of success of some surgery procedure was 85%, for example, he would cover 85 of those blocks and say, you know, each block is, you know, represents 1%. And so 85 of these are colored in, 15 have a negative effect or bad response or something. Using that to convey that, and that's what a waffle chart is. And so, again, it's the same thing. It's using area, except it's divided up into these evenly spaced squares. And so area is down on the thing there. But he found that people could easily count and translate these into very precise numbers with waffle chart. But that's not what Cleveland and McGill were talking about here, right? But they still, these are fundamental building blocks. And that's why this paper is so critical when we talk about data visualization. The second paper that I think we should talk about is from McInlay. And McInlay wrote this, I believe, 2 years later, looking at trying to extend that original work. And rather than just focus on the quantitative encoding numbers and things like that, he extend this into other types of data. And he looked at ordinal data and he looked at nominal or categorical data. And ordinal data is things that are ordered, you know, high, medium, low, first, second, third, things like that, where there's an order to them, but the actual distance between, say, first and second place is irrelevant. Just the fact that you're in first and the fact that you're in second is what's important. And so when encoding something in ordinal, what he found is that position was still high on the top there, but then using color saturation and color hue, we're quite good at this, as opposed to a quantitative scale where color saturation and hue were at the bottom of the list. So to encode a quantity, color hue and color saturation are really bad. And this is what we see a lot on maps, right? If you're trying to do a choropleth, like we did in the beginning of the data breach investigations report, where you have a world map or a US map or something, and you color, say, states in or countries in a certain color, trying to convey a quantity, that's a really imprecise way to encode something. Because when people decode the color hue, you know, if it's going from a yellow to a red or something like that on this gradual scale, the human eye and the brain is very, very poor at decoding that type of message for a quantitative value. But when we talk about an ordinal thing, it's pretty easy if you're just trying to establish order. If you have something that's a very bright yellow to a little bit more of an orange going into red, you can tell that there's an order to that. And so this is high up on the ordinal scale. The other thing with a categorical variable, and these are nominal, is what it's cited in the paper. And again, position is a great way to determine a nominal difference. Then he has color, hue, and texture and things like that up on top. And this is what we use a lot, right? And we did this and we looked at these sub-industries in figure 19 in this year's report, where we tried to group the sub-industries of a high-level industry. And so they're part of a category. And so to denote that, we used we talked about the 20 colors from D3, right? The D3 20 colors, and how we use those categorical colors to represent the category. And so that's up on the top. And so these are two papers. They're very fundamental to data visualization. And that's something I wanted to get out and talk about first here, Bob.
Yeah, actually, I think bringing up both of those two papers is really fundamental, both because they've been around for a while and are kind of seminal works in the field. Like they've actually influenced many of the different tools that people get to use. And with regard to the McInlay one, I mean that's even now the logic that's inside there is in an application that everyone can use for free, which is Tableau. And actually that's a great way to learn a lot of these rules that the paper talks about by actually bringing your data into Tableau and letting it tell you or suggest to you what some of the possible good core visualizations for those things might be, because it understands a lot of these things and it presents that to you. That's one of the strengths. It's one of the reasons why it was actually developed. And I like the other paper also just because it's not an opinion, right? It's not about percentages of social security numbers, which is an opinion. It's actually based upon actual real data. That these guys did a study on, got real people, measured things, and were able to do some statistics on that to actually understand what some of that is. So it's always great when you can base things on data instead of pure, analyst conjecture like that. So but what was interesting when we were, like you said, what brought some of this up was, when we got schooled by Lane, so we went back to school. But for our guest we have on the show today, Brandon Dixon, one of the reasons that visualization became really, strong, like I think a good topic for the show is that he worked on a visualization for PassiveTotal that we'll talk about later, that basically went from looking at just gobs and gobs of tabular text and IP addresses and dates and numbers and whatever, and took that and made it into something that was extremely visual that you could determine things right away and gain some significant insight with just, a quick look at a visualization. And that brought to mind an example from the book, but it's a classic example in data visualization of Anscombe's quartet. And so real briefly for listeners, since most people are probably familiar with it, but for the few that aren't, it's basically four sets of XY pairs. And when you look at the statistics of them, right, if you look at the actual, just basic summary statistics of these different tables, they actually look very much the same. Like you really wouldn't be able to say statistically that there was any deviation between them. But when you graph the XY pairs into four separate graphs, you get to see a whole new different thing, right? Everything, you've got one that shows up as a curve, one that shows up as a straight line, one that's got an outlier. I mean, it's basically, drastically different. And I think it was a great example that Anscombe put together to show the importance of, and the equal importance of, now the one is more important, of doing both a statistical analysis and also a visual analysis of the data that you have when you're about to do exploratory stuff and kind of go forth and find other questions to ask and answer from the data. And it just, it's he's like a modern day, InfoSec Anscombe, as I think folks will learn. But the other thing is when we were setting up talking about, doing a show on just visualization, that there was an interesting paper from coming up, and it's going to be in Use R. It's about a new package called Braille R.
Oh, I heard about that. Yeah, that's very exciting.
And it's really interesting because what it is it's actually developed by a blind statistician, and it's like a blind visualization package, which is a weird thing to sort of say, but right now it works with many of the base plot in the in R the base plot routines in R, and it lets you say make a histogram just like you would normally make a histogram, and if you're a sighted person you'll see it, but if you use Braille R it kind of intercepts. The way R will let you do that, it'll actually intercept some of the object dispatch. And when that plot method gets called, it will actually not only visually show it on the graphics display, which obviously you won't be able to see if you're blind, but it will then describe the histogram. And what's great about that is, if you're using something like an actual, like the base R app on systems, because R Studio actually does not support screen readers, which is interesting. I didn't know that until I read the paper. You can have the screen reader can actually read through that text, so if you can make it audible, or it can actually go out to a Braille environment, I guess, as well too. But then you get a description of what the histogram is, and it supports other plots too, and it's going to support more as time goes by. But that made me think that, it may be an interesting exercise to, at least if you can't describe a plot that you've just made, so that a blind person could understand it of what you're trying to communicate. And maybe it's obviously it's not going to work for every type of visualization, but I think for some of the core ones that we try to communicate with almost every day, that might not be a bad exercise for us to actually go through, as we're all kind of making charts and graphs and stuff for people, is to try to ensure that, you can decode that in a way that folks will see it in a pretty systematic way, almost kind of like a reverse tableau, if you will, for the actual chart. So
right.
Yeah, just watch for that package. Watch for the there's going to be a paper coming out as well once USAR kicks off. So I think people would be pretty interested in seeing how that comes out.
So I want to add on to your Anscombe's Quartet discussion real quick, and it's something actually that Brandon called out in his blog post, and that is talking about the brain's ability, our ability as people to absorb things visually. You know, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and that's because our brain is so capable of absorbing things visually. And in our book, we start out chapter 6 with a quote, and I want to read that quote. I have it right here. And it's a quote from Colin Ware, who wrote a book called Information Visualization. And he's probably one of the leading researchers into this cognitive ability. And he has, actually, it's almost very little to do with visualization, all about the cognitive processing of the brain and things like that. And you can tell as reading Colin Ware's book that he was also a huge influence on Stephen Few. It's interesting seeing, you know, you read some part of that book and you're like, oh, that's where Few got that, right? So, but the quote here says, the human visual system is a pattern seeker of enormous power and subtlety. The eye and the visual cortex of the brain form a massively parallel processor that provides the highest bandwidth channel into the human cognitive centers. And I think that really just captures it, saying that the best way to really shove information into the brain, if we can talk about that, is visually. And I think that's a really strong statement.
I think that provides a great segue into our segment with Brandon Dixon of Passive Total. Brandon has a passion for security research and developing tools and services that can help researchers and defenders. So let's start off with what got Brandon into information security.
Yeah, sure. So I started information security in high school. I went through a specialized networking program and started going to college classes at night. I got kind of lucky with my career because information security at the time was starting to blow up. A lot of the certifications coming out, a lot of, you know, hacking-based courses were of interest to many people. So after I graduated high school, my first job was with a defense contractor where I got to do a lot of networking things, but also got exposed to a lot of information security, trying to automate aspects of my job. So I was doing a little bit of research, a little bit of programming. After that, I did more consulting, and I did consulting for a few years. And that kind of gave me the opportunity to see a bunch of different things, figure out what I liked, figure out what I didn't like. And it was in that position where I kind of found that, you know, research and development was something that I was interested in the security space. So from there, I went over to a university, did more research, did more development. And now I've been in the private sector where I've continued to kind of develop tools, mostly focusing on the analyst.
And so that's a good transition then into Passive Total. So what is Passive Total? What does the platform aim to do?
So Passive Total is largely built off a combination of active and passive DNS data. You can think of that data as kind of a snapshot of network infrastructure at any given period of time. So for example, if I try to resolve google.com today, it may go over to 8.8.8.8. And if I went and tried to resolve that tomorrow, it could go to 4.4.4.4. So this kind of works both ways. If I queried for 4.4.4.4, I might see that it resolves to dns.google.com. So what's interesting with all this data is, like, you know, if you're doing an investigation on your network, you have something that's potentially suspicious, it's helpful to know, okay, what did this suspicious item resolve to at the time that I think my network may have been compromised? Or, you know, what is its entire, like, duration? What's its history? And essentially what Passive Total is it's a platform that combines a bunch of different passive DNS sources and distills them into one unified view. But beyond that, beyond just showing that data, we also give the analysts the necessary enrichment data that helps them come to a conclusion as to whether or not something is malicious or not. And what's nice about that is, like, we also allow the analysts to persist aspects of their research inside of the platform. So, you know, if I say this domain is malicious, you know, several months from now, when I'm pivoting around and looking at different infrastructure, that domain may pop up again, and I'll know that it's malicious because I had previously marked it.
Hmm. Interesting.
And I'm just happy that that's not yet another threat asterisk company.
It could be.
No, but just don't use that. There's far too many threats out there. The I think totals are way better than threats, so that's cool.
Threat total.
There you go.
Oh no, don't. No. See, now what's gonna happen next week? There's gonna be like three new startups fighting for that. Thanks. That's
so good. Well, we thought about going meta and doing total, but
So we have you on because you recently, I think it was even just this past week from when we're recording, did a pretty cool blog post that had a really interesting data visualization for a really interesting reason. And I really would like to have you share with folks what that was, how you came to do it, et cetera. So, like, you know, can you start talking a little bit about, you know, that blog post and the visualization that you developed?
Yeah. So the blog post outlined one of our new features inside of PassiveTotal, where we take all of that combined passive DNS data and we plot it into various points on a grid. So the x-axis represents the previous 6 months of time, and the y-axis represents the individual days of the week, starting with Sunday. So each square inside of the grid is filled with an amount of unique resolution, so there's a tiny count inside of each square. As well as like a color that kind of signifies properties depending on what you queried for. So if I queried for a domain, the grid will be filled with IP-based data, and those properties might be whether or not the IP was a routable address or a non-routable address. If I queried for an IP address and it was filled with domains, the properties there might be, you know, whether or not the domain is dynamic, or whether or not it's a, you know, purchase domain from a registrar.
So what were you doing before that you needed this visualization? What was it like before that you did this new visualization?
So essentially before we had this, and it's still there now, it was an HTML table. So a lot of what analysts are used to in the community is, you know, you get back a lot of data and you put it inside of a table and you can sort it and kind of pivot around. And that's primarily what we were doing. We were taking all of those combined results and having each of them inside of an individual row. Users could sort on various details. It was very difficult to interpret all of the data. In some cases, it was like 5 records, so it's fairly easy to digest. But in other cases, when you have thousands of records across multiple years, it's very difficult to see where there's unique occurrences of data or there's overlap between, you know, different pieces of infrastructure.
Yeah. And so that's what you're trying to solve is the, you know, when you're looking at more than just a handful, you know, pieces of data, that you wanted some way to quickly absorb that information, right?
Yeah, I wanted a way to know whether or not something was useful in a split second. Without me having to actually go through the detailed data, I wanted some sort of like indication that like what I'm looking at is old, or what I'm looking at is highly active, or what I'm looking at hasn't resolved to a routable address in the past 6 months. Something that could give me that cue that said, okay, this is something that's interesting. I want to spend more time looking at it.
So you reference an MIT article in your blog post when you're talking about the visualization, and I'm wondering, did you immediately go towards the heat map, or was that sort of an iterative process? Like, did you try other types of visuals before you settled on that for how you wanted to kind of get that faster way of identifying things that are bad?
So the heat, like, what was interesting about the visual decision is that, you know, I had read studies like that, and I had seen other things, but the heat map was not the first thing that we went to. It was actually a timeline. So this data naturally fits inside of a timeline, or it's just time-based in general. So the first iteration that we had of this in the first version of PassiveTotal was a timeline that would essentially it was the same concept as our heat map. It would plot the varying, IP addresses onto a long timeline that was a JavaScript library, and you could kind of drag across and you could see where there were overlapping lines, but it was very difficult to digest that data despite it being the proper way to show it.
Cool. And actually that's a great segue. So it looks like, obviously, since it's on a web page, it's probably not Java or Flash. It looks like it's JavaScript. I didn't actually dig into it. Which libraries did you kind of center around, or were you familiar with? Did you use, or did you have to look at new ones that you had, or did you build it from scratch, like on your own completely?
So the first iteration of the heat map was actually using a JavaScript library that plotted like calendars and things like that. And as I started to use it, I realized that it wasn't necessarily built for what we were trying to do. So there's a lot of heavy modification to it to kind of force it into what we were trying to represent in terms of like the colors and the different points and the borders around the boxes, etc. So after trying to get that to work, I realized that we would just have to roll our own solution. What we have in place right now is actually not JavaScript at all. It's a server-side generated HTML table. The irony is not lost on me that, we've replaced one table for another, but in this case, we actually have something that represents the actual heat map. In the future, we'd like to port that over to using something that's more canvas-based, maybe using a D3JS.
Okay. And is this generated real time? Like the user will make a query and then it's generated on the server and it's returned back to the user.
Correct. So the heat maps are generated on the fly every time you run a query. So it's as real time as you can get. With our data, there's a lot of things change quickly. So we're constantly trying to make sure that we have the most updated data. But beyond that, each individual inside of the platform may have access to different sources. So that adds a layer of complexity in that we can't merely show the same heat map every single time. We have to show differing heat maps based on the sources you're allowed to see.
Interesting. Okay. And have people been using this already? Is it already rolled out that people can try out the heat map?
Yeah. So we had rolled this out when we did a beta rewrite several months ago. The initial feedback was, not many people liked it. They thought it was, taking up a lot of real estate on the screen. It was slow at times. So since pushing out the new version of PassiveTotal, we've included the heat map. We've had it rewritten. It renders faster. And we think that by doing that blog post, we kind of explain what it is that we're trying to achieve. We kind of expected people to kind of hate it just because it's 100% new. As far as I know, nobody has ever like taken data like this and represented it inside of a visual like this. So it's natural that people would say, this is ridiculous. What are you doing? But, we feel there's value in it. We use it a lot. And I know other people are starting to come around to it.
Yeah. So did you have that ramp up period yourself? Like, as you started using it, was there an initial period where it just kind of took you a little bit, but now that you know how to read it, you understand the different variables that are represented, that you can look at it and absorb that information rather rapidly now, right?
Yeah. I think what makes visuals difficult is that not only do they have to be pleasing aesthetically, they have to be simple enough to understand almost intuitively. And with our heat map, it's, one of the pitfalls to it is that it's not quite as intuitive as we'd want. When people see that, it's kind of jarring at first because, it's like, what is this map? What does it correspond to? So even for us, like the people who created it, when I initially saw that all the time, I'm like, this isn't that great. But as I forced myself to look at it more, I realized I'm like, okay, if I see a blank grid, that means that there is no data for the past 6 months. Instantly. And if I see like a giant blue grid and I'm looking, if I've queried for a domain, I instantly know that like this thing is resolving to non-routable addresses. Or I see like, that one square inside of the heat map is being like a different color than everything else. My brain instantly tells me that day is interesting. What happened that day?
All right. Yeah. Now, your background is in networking and security, mainly security. Have you evolved much into the visualization world and data analysis and stuff like that? Are you still, like, how did you get into doing viz from security?
So I've always had an interest in the arts. So, you know, I like art outside of work in general. And in my earlier research, I had used some visual libraries in order to represent malicious PDF objects. Specifically, we were looking at entropy and trying to compare different objects inside of a PDF. So I found that visuals were helpful in that. And that kind of never left me. But I think what sort of revived my interest in visualization and made me spend a lot more time with it was a TED talk that I saw. And it was, I think it was Neil Havison. And the talk was like listening in color. And what I found interesting about the talk was that it was a colorblind artist who essentially had a color sensor installed in, like mounted into the back of his skull. And it basically has like a camera on the front of his head. And what it's capable of doing is translating that color into frequencies that then play inside of his head. So it's not quite a visualization, but when I heard that talk, I instantly realized, like, you know, one of the things that was cool is that he said, you know, to see someone's face, it was no longer just like what their face looked like. It was also like, were they pleasing to the ears because of the color and the complexion that they had. And what I thought was interesting about that was, as I heard that, I thought to myself, first, could we take the data that we're representing and represent it as a sound? That was the first iteration of that. And then I thought, well, let's be more realistic here. Like, is it possible to distill all of this information inside of some visual that is easy to understand and is a complete different way of viewing something?
So, you know, having done this and kind of experimented with your, you know, the people that use, you know, PassiveTotal, I guess what advice might you give to others who are, you know, maybe either using your stuff or, you know, kind of sitting in an enterprise or an organization and trying to sift through, you know, tons of data about kind of trying to do more visually than they might be, like, you know, what advice can you give to them to do more visualizations or try to use them for their analyses?
So, I mean, my advice is, I guess, limited in a way because I don't really view myself as an expert at all. Like, you know, one of the things that I've started doing recently is reading more books on design. So The Design of Everyday Things by Don Norman is an incredibly simple book, but at the same time, very complex, and it makes you view the world a bit differently. So I think that translates very well to the cyber world and, you know, reading any sort of like user experience books, you know, asking people for feedback and trying to approach things as if like you know nothing about this topic. So my advice when it comes to visualizations is to experiment, to figure out what works, to basically fail fast. Like, if, you know, don't try to like force people into a visualization if it's not going to work. Don't try to put too much data inside of a visualization, but at least try something. You know, rearrange things, plot different pieces of data, you know, really think about the questions that you're trying to answer, what you're trying to do.
And do you have any other plans that you can talk about? Because, you know, like it is a service you offer, a paying service, for other visualization projects for PassiveTotal. Like, is this the end of visualization experimentation, or are you going to be doing a bit more around the service?
No, I definitely like to continue to do more. I think, you know, there's the free element of the service, like, allows us to kind of run these different experiments. And what's nice is, you know, we're looking to basically take the existing heat map and add a couple more features to it. So right now, when you hover over a day, you can see the unique resolutions that occurred on that day. And additionally, there's a visual cue that tells you, hey, something new, never before seen, occurred on this day. What we'd like to have is the ability to get that value and show it to the user, but beyond that, allow them to click on an individual day and see and like filter out all of the results to just that day, to get so that you can take that giant table that's below the heat map and get a very small condensed version. And in a perfect world, you'd be able to shift click and, you know, get an entire week or get a custom period of time. Moving beyond that, I think the next logical step is to take that heat map concept and allow individuals to plot multiple values on it. So now you could see the overlap between two different domains, three different domains, and begin to understand, like, where's the sharing between, you know, different infrastructures or patterns of when they, you know, go routable to non-routable and so on.
Well, Brandon Dixon, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.